This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon. You're listening to Live and Learn on The Bigger Picture with me, Lim Soo Ann. Law and Behold is a series aimed at improving constitutional literacy among Malaysians, done in collaboration with the Malaysian Bar and the University of Malaya's Faculty of Law. In our fifth episode of the series, we'll be looking at gender equality and specifically discrimination against women through the lenses of both the Federal Constitution of Malaysia as well as the Women's Convention. So joining me today are Firdaus Husni, the Chief Human Rights Strategist at the Malaysian Centre for Constitutionalism and Human Rights, and Ki Hui Yi, a member of the Bar Council Constitutional Law Committee. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
So to start off, perhaps could you tell me how gender equality is covered under our constitution?
So under the Article 8 of the Federal Constitution, Article 8.1 says that all persons are equal before the law and entitled to the equal protection of the law. Under subsection 2, the word gender is included for equal protection before the law. But the interesting point is the word gender was not in the Federal Constitution until the Amendment Act in 2001.
Mm-hmm. And so far, how has Article 8 and its subparagraphs been interpreted in Malaysian law?
So the interesting point is that the courts have, throughout these years, they have taken a very narrow approach in interpreting subsection 2 in a way that it says it only protects, it only gives protection to gender equality in terms of public authority. In other words, we have case law that says that if you are employed by government, you are government servant and you are discriminated against on the ground of gender, you are protected. But if you are employed by a private company, you're actually not protected.
And if I'm not mistaken, this was exemplified in the Beatrice Fernandez case?
Yeah, correct. So in the Beatrice case, it's a air stewardess. So she was employed by a private company, obviously. And the court actually held that because you're employed by a private company and you had an employment contract with the private company. So basically the court is saying that you kind of consented. You shouldn't get pregnant while you're employed. So the court says, oh, so sorry, Article 8 doesn't apply to you.
And I also read that Article 8 allows for discrimination in personal laws. Hui, maybe you can explain what this means?
So basically, Article 8.5 implicitly authorizes gender discrimination in regard to personal law. So generally, we are talking about Muslims, we are talking about your customary law, your religion, that kind of thing. So under Article 8.5, it kind of says that it is okay if you you discriminate someone if it's in regard to personal law. So I think years ago when we had the case about the Juzali's case, the cross-dressing case. So the enactment actually says that as a Muslim male, you cannot dress or behave like a woman in public. So that is the problem, I think, we have under the Federal Constitution when it authorizes, you can just discriminate if it's a personal law.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, we've been talking about discrimination. So what would we constitute as discrimination under Malaysian law? Is there a definition to what we would call discrimination?
At the moment, it really depends on what the case law says. Yeah,
I think under the legislation, there's no definition to the word discrimination.
Mm. But when we talk about gender discrimination, the way things are, they are, campaigns and also movements to try to have a specific definition on gender discrimination. And I'm talking about the move to have the gender equality law, that's one, and also sexual harassment law. So this has been going on for quite some time. And I think it's, I would say it has almost like, you know, I want to say it has almost reached a conclusion, but at the moment we don't even see it being tabled at the parliament. So that's the hope that I think the women's rights group have now, so that, you know, the concern that you mentioned earlier would be addressed. Yeah, yeah.
Mm-hmm. And why do you think that having a gender equality law is important? No.
There's a few, from my perspective, I'd say there's a few reasons to it. Yeah. One, yes, you know, as Huyi mentioned earlier, it's good that our constitution recognizes that there shouldn't be discrimination based on gender. And this amendment was done way back when? 2000?
2001,
yeah. But until today, yeah, for example, we do hear instances of gender discrimination. We do hear instances of sexual harassment against women. And I think all the instances leads to a conclusion that more has to be done. And a recognition under the Constitution alone is not enough. Yeah. And if I were to take this further also, if you look in the participation of women in public and political life, yeah, if you want to say that, oh, that recognition under the federal constitution means a milestone and oh, that's it, we already achieved gender equality, why do we still have less than, what, 30%, barely 10% of women lawmakers in parliament? Yeah. And also, there's also a move to look into how many female are there in company boards.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and the fact that we are still talking about it means we still have some ways to go.
Mm-hmm. And we have been speaking of gender equality, but could you elaborate more on what does it mean when we say equality? Does it simply mean that we recognize equality between men and women in law? Do we need that first?
Yes, I think the term equality, if I'm trying not to go too academic here, but the term equality, you know, either in relation to gender equality or either in relation to, say, racial equality, there's a lot of nuances in the sense that the first question would be, does that mean when you talk about gender equality, you treat men and women exactly the same?
Mm-hmm.
Is that the approach we should take? And to that question, I would say no, simply because, among others, they are, one, there are biological differences between men and women. That's number one. And number two, there are differences in terms of what the society expects of the role of men and women. And I'll give you an example. Say, you know, a couple just got married. Yeah. Usually, it will come, you know, either from the family side or either, you know, even from the new husband, the new wife is expected to be the one taking care of the house, you know, doing the cooking, and then when they have children, to take care of the child, basically caring for the home and caring for children. And in some cases, you know, when they are the, you know, elderly parents, to take care of the elderly parents, it's the responsibility falls on the woman first. Why can't that be seen as a shared responsibility between both? So going back to your question, yeah, when we talk about sameness, when we talk about equality, you need to take into account the differences of expectation and biological differences between these two to see what works best to achieve gender equality.
Mm-hmm.
That's, I guess, the simple explanation.
But if we have a law on gender equality, like say if we have a Gender Equality Act, but it would first, so it should include all these differences?
I think if you, from my perspective, if you talk about gender equality law, these nuances when it comes to achieving gender equality is what we must first recognize. And if I can relate this to, there was one instance I remember. I was, you know, sitting down after an event, And I was saying that, oh, that event was about, you know, women's empowerment. We were talking about gender equality. And a guy in the group suddenly said, you know, he suddenly got a bit riled up and he was like, okay, if you were talking about gender equality, why can't the men have the same days of paternity leave when as the woman? And to me, that reflects the low awareness when you talk about gender equality. That reflects the low awareness when you talk about the fact that men and women have different biological differences. Yeah. So hopefully, if we have Gender Equality Act, it will address that awareness. And, you know, if it's not in the content, but I think what must come with the passing of that act is the move to get this awareness, awareness be imparted to both men and women.
I'm speaking to Firdaus Husni, the Chief Human Rights Strategist at the Malaysian Centre for Constitutionalism and Human Rights, and also Ki Hui Yi, a member of the Bar Council Constitutional Law Committee, who are discussing Article 8 of the Constitution and what it means for gender equality in Malaysia. We'll continue our discussion after a quick break. You're listening to Live and Learn on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9. Welcome back to Live and Learn on The Bigger Picture with me, Lim Soo Ann. You're listening to our Law and Behold series, which is aimed at improving constitutional literacy among Malaysians. It is done in collaboration with the Malaysian Bar and the University of Malaya's Faculty of Law. With me in the studio are lawyers Firdaus Husni and Ki Hui Yi, and we're discussing Article 8 of the Constitution in relation to gender equality and discrimination against women. Thus far, based on Malaysian case law and cases cases domestically, or you know, just the laws that have been enacted, have there been any changes that show a greater recognition of the discrimination that women have faced and recognizing that they do feel a disproportionate impact of certain issues?
I think the most famous case will be Noor Fadila's case. Mm. So the brief facts of the case will be she was employed as a, we call it part-time teacher, by the government. And then when she became pregnant, she notified the government, and then later on her contract was terminated. The reason the government gave was actually in court. The government, she said that we are employing you as a part-time teacher, but now you are pregnant, which means we actually have to find a replacement for you when you are away for your maternity leave, and you know you might have some health issue or concerns during your pregnancy. So the government thinks that a pregnant woman can't teach or just can't do work as a teacher when she's pregnant. So basically, eventually, the court actually said that CEDAW, the UN Convention on the Elimination of All Forms of Discrimination Against Women, in Noor Fadila's case, the court actually said that because of this international law, the court has the responsibility, the court can take into consideration this CEDAW, and basically, the court says that you can't discriminate against a pregnant lady. You can't say that because she's pregnant, you can just, at your liberty, terminate her.
Mm-hmm. And I did read that the court did employ Article 8 in Noor Fadila's case, and one reason why it held up in favour of Noor Fadila was because she was working in the public sector compared to Beatrice Fernandez, who was working in the private sector.
You're right.
And is that an issue that needs to be rectified, the public-private divide?
To me, I think it should, because there's no reason why a lady or a woman, you know, why you should differentiate a woman who works in the public sector and a private sector. Are you saying that the employers in private sector have no responsibility at all to rectify the whole thing, to help in the empowerment of women? Or you, because you are just a private employers, you can discriminate on any basis that you want because you think that, you know, if my employees work for me because I'm a private company, they are not protected by the federal constitution. To me, that's just ridiculous.
When it comes to, for example, the Domestic Violence Acts or the Penal Code and crimes such as rape that disproportionately affect women, have there been positive changes? Or are there laws that do favour women when it comes to these kind of crimes?
Well, when it comes to domestic violence, there are a couple of issues. But one that I can think of that is still ongoing is the fact that under our penal code, marital rape is not recognised as rape. And I think that not too long ago, probably 2-3 years ago, this was a point of conversation and a point of controversy, actually. Because, when you talk about rape and the fact that, it's done without consent and it's done as a form of violence, exerting power and control over women, that is the recognition that we won, by having this in the law, And that is what the women's group are pushing for. And at the moment, I think it's not happening yet.
But we do recognise that consent is an important element when it comes to rape, right?
That's right.
So you mentioned marital rape is not criminalised. Why do you think it has been so difficult?
Among the main objection of the move to have marital rape recognised is on the basis that it goes against what the religion of Islam says. And so I'd say within the context of Malaysia, as is the case with a lot of other issues, things do get, the conversation usually gets a bit frustrated whenever someone mentioned, oh, it's because it's religion, and so therefore there's no further question about it, which is a shame because, as a Muslim, I'd like to say even within Islam, there are diversity in terms of opinion, and we should explore this with the end goal of which approach would provide justice and fairness to the parties impacted by the whole situation. I think this should be the approach taken rather than stopping a conversation and say, oh, it's because the in our religion, there's no such thing as marital rape, full stop. So I would say that conversation and that kind of trajectory of discussion will not be fruitful to the parties involved.
And I think to add on to that, I think it's a very archaic law in the sense that women used to be treated as a property in the past. And sadly, I think until today, the perception is still there, which is very, very sad, which is why under the Penal Code, Section 498, it is also an offence to entice a married woman. But to think about it, that's because they think the husband owns the wife. So you can't actually take away my wife. It is wrong when another man takes away my wife. It is discriminatory in a sense that it doesn't work the other way around. Mm. So a woman, technically, you can't actually, arrest or, you can't prosecute someone for enticing your husband. So, in a sense, that's just wrong.
On a similar note, if I get this correctly, stalking is also not criminalised in our laws?
Not that I know.
Not for now. I think the NGOs are also pushing really hard, but I think we haven't heard anything from the government.
Why is it important for stalking to be criminalised?
I think in a way, it will help to protect men and women better, in a sense that because we are living in such a digital era where you can get the information about any individuals at any rate, right? You just Google my name up, you probably know where I'm working at. You probably know where I'm, where is my house. And there's actually no avenue. There's no way you can stop this behavior, I would say. So to me personally, I would think, anti-stalking law will help. But I also think that there should be more conversation to be carried out regarding this issue. I think all parties should be involved when you want to enact such a law.
Mm. I'd say stalking. whenever you hear of, stories or accounts of your friend being stalked, you just can't help feeling angry on their behalf, isn't it? Mm-hmm. And I think that just shows how men and women, although they share the same public space, but men do not face, the same kind of sense of security that, or rather the lack of security that the woman face. And that is why, you know, we still need to be talking about having a law against stalking. That to me also brings forth the point of, you know, why if you look under the CEDAW, the Convention on the Elimination of All Forms of Discrimination Against Women, which Malaysia ratified, CEDAW under Article 7 talks about the right for women to participate in public and political life. But if you don't have a safe space for women to move about within that public and political sphere, how can they truly or effectively participate? You know, it's really, for example, you expect women to put in the same hours, you know, and sometimes, let's say it can't be helped, it's because of a project, yeah? But the street is not safe for women to walk to get home if they were to, you know, be late in the office.
So you mentioned CEDAW, and we'll get to that in a bit. Mm-hmm. But first, another point that I found that has been seen as quite discriminatory against women is the lack of gender equality in nationality law in Malaysia. From the statistics that I found, Malaysia is one of only 25 countries that actually deny women the right to confer nationality on their children on an equal basis to men. It's one of three countries that deny men equal rights in conferring nationality on their children who are born out of wedlock. And also one of roughly 50 countries that deny women an equal right to confer nationality on their spouses. So there seems to be a discrimination not only against women, but also against men in some respects. So do you think it's time for us to amend the federal constitution to eliminate these internal inconsistencies that allow us to discriminate based on gender, regardless of whether you are a man or a woman?
Yes, I would say, you know, the time is overdue for us to actually amend that law. If you want to talk about gender equality, if you want to talk about effective gender equality, and the government should lead the way. But at the moment, the way things are, I know we'll be talking about CEDAW later, but if you look under the reservation that the government placed under CEDAW, nationality law was also included as one of the reservation. And is there a political will from the side of the government to remove this reservation? At the moment, I do not think so. And that's unfortunate.
Yeah, I think you also talk about it. It's interesting. It actually harms both the women and men, in a different context, right? So, for example, to me, I think my concern is when it comes to, for example, says, citizenship, or, you know, we even have cases like Bin Abdullah when it comes to an illegitimate child. I think that's the most probably sensitive word and issue, that it's one of the most sensitive issues in our country, whether it's just a general perspective of the society or in terms of religion. People just think that if you are not married, even though the father and biological father and the mother are agreeable to take care of the child, mm-hmm. we just confer them the term illegitimate child. And then in that sense, actually under the Birth and Registration Act, interestingly, the biological father cannot have his name registered on the birth certificate of the child without the word that is used in the act is a joint request with the mother. And also, the child cannot have his surname, even though, you know, he said that I am his biological father. He can't have his surname for the kid if the mother is not agreeable. It just, to me, I just feel like it's not doing any good to any parties.
Mm. So, as I mentioned earlier, let's look towards an international level right now. We have mentioned CEDAW several times throughout the interview now, and Malaysia has adopted it. But what is the significance of CEDAW and the fact that we, Malaysia, have acceded to it?
So, CEDAW looks into all forms of discrimination against women. And as party to CEDAW, Malaysia, you know, the ideal situation is that Malaysia should move towards complying with all of the articles under CEDAW. Yeah? At the moment, if you look under, you know, how international law works, if a country accedes or ratifies to an international convention, it is for that country to either ratify it without any reservations, or if they want, they can also put reservations. So that is the case with Malaysia. We basically say that we will comply to all of the provisions in CEDAW except for certain provisions. Yeah, and if I can share this provision, yeah, one would be, earlier we've already discussed the law regarding nationality, and also the law regarding rights of women on marriage, divorce, and also over their children custody. Yeah, one other thing in which it was highlighted is the fact that at the moment, Malaysia has yet to ratify the optional protocol to CEDAW. And what difference does it make? Once Malaysia ratified that optional protocol, yeah, if a woman feels that their rights, you know, set out in the CEDAW is violated, they can actually go directly to CEDAW committee for adjudication. But at the moment, that recourse is not available because we are not signatory to the optional protocol to CEDAW.
So Malaysia acceded to CEDAW back in 1995, and it's been almost 25 years since then. Do you think CEDAW has impacted how we address gender discrimination, if at all?
I want to say yes, but unfortunately, I don't think that's what's happening with regard to, you know, the advancement of women's rights in Malaysia and us ratifying CEDAW. Yeah, simply because there are women's groups who observe that when it comes to women's rights, especially Malay Muslim women, we seem to have regressed instead of progress. And so that is one of the observation. Yeah, and you know, the reservation that I mentioned earlier. Yeah, even at the latest CEDAW review, what came up from that review is that we are not, you know, it does not look like that we are going anywhere near removing these reservations. So, yeah, there still needs to be a lot of conversation on that.
Mm-hmm. And Hui, I think you mentioned earlier that in the Nur Fadila case, the courts did refer to CEDAW. So does that mean that we can apply CEDAW in domestic cases?
I think so in Nur Fadila's case, basically the court said that since the government has ratified it, it is the court's responsibility and court can take into consideration international treaties that the government has signed. So in this case, the court held that CEDAW is binding on the courts. But I think, again, Nur Fadila is employed by the government. Again, so we aren't sure if it's, you know, in a private sector, we don't know how it will go.
What are some of the main obstacles that prevent us from improving or achieving gender equality?
Okay, I feel gender equality is, you hear, you know, women's group talking about it, but I still think it's not enough. Yeah. For example, if I can just give one of the easiest example would be whenever people hear of a women's group, a women's NGO, you know, your immediate thought would be, oh, some, you know, that's a group of some angry women. That in itself reflects the stereotype that society has on women in general. Yeah, that's one. Second, for example, how many times whenever we say in organizations or whenever we organize a forum or a talk, yeah, if somebody didn't point out, more often than not, it will be an all-male panel. There's even a term for it. I think they call it MANEL, which stands for an all-male panel. And the fact that it has to be pointed out, look, where are you know, female in this lineup? And I don't know whether this is a parody. I hope it's a parody. But someone was the other day was forwarding me a photo of a forum on women empowerment, but there was no woman in the lineup at all. That's just preposterous, if you ask me. So that's one. And I would like to relate this, you know, to the fact that when we talk about gender equality, yes, you know, we talk about the law, we talk about having legal protection. And these are important, yes. But I would say what we hope to achieve, and not just through the law, yeah, but, you know, yes, I can see how, you know, having this in place through a legal protection, a legal mechanism, could also spur discussions. We should also look at having what we call a substantive law. So what we have in the law, you know, Article 8.2, for example, it's what we call a formal equality, but we should also think about substantive equality. And what does substantive equality mean? It essentially means, rather than looking only at the surface, looking at what does the law says, you should also take into account the fact that there is still gender stereotyping, there is still gender discrimination, and there is still prejudices in the mindset of the society. And because of that, we must take steps to transform that mind. And also, you know, they are also, and you look at that, some of the arguments surrounding this, they call it transformative equality. And to me, it's an important discussion that we should also look into. And someone actually said this, and I thought it's interesting. Someone says, if all men are born free, how is it that all women are born slaves? And I think that quote is born from the mentality and the mindset that society has about the role of women in society. And this was actually recognized under CEDAW. And Article 7 talk about the fact that government, the state parties, have to take all measures, whatever measures, to eliminate discrimination against women in the political and public life, in particular to ensure women on equal terms with men. Yeah. So that has been the conversation when you talk about public and political participation. And in Malaysia, I think we still has a long way to go looking into how many women are lawmakers, how many women are in, you know, in the company boards. Just look at how women politician or whoever, a public figure, right? If that woman is a public figure, the kind of criticism that woman receive would differ than the kind of criticism a male politician would receive. Yeah, if I can relate this, not too long ago, a friend of mine, she made a public statement, yeah, and a public statement that has nothing to do with gender. It was just on an issue of current concern, yeah. And then next thing we know, she was bombarded with rape threats, injury threats, death threats, yeah, that she had to go and make a police report. And that is sad. And I can tell you, if it's a male friend of mine making the same public statement, I do not think that friend will receive the same barrage of criticism hurtful remarks that's been thrown to this friend of mine.
Thank you so much for joining me today.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
So you've been listening to Law and Behold, where I've been speaking to Firdaus Husni, the Chief Human Rights Strategist at the Malaysian Centre for Constitutionalism and Human Rights, and Ki Hui Yi, a member of the Bar Council Constitutional Law Committee on Gender Equality and Discrimination Against Women in Malaysia. If you've missed any part of this interview or any previous Live and Learn interviews, you can download the podcast on our website, on our BFM app, or on Spotify. This has been Live and Learn on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.